Hey everyone, just want to encourage you to find us on your listening platform and give us a rating. Anywhere you listen to that has a rating system, go on over and give us a rating and maybe leave us a review. Let us know your thoughts. These ratings really do help. Thank you so much for listening. On to this week's episode. Rolando.
What's up?
Tell me nice things about Tom Ripley.
Okay, I can. He's a master at forgeries. He's manipulative. He's a gaslighter. He's handsome. Sometimes hot, depending on the depiction.
Yes. Is he charismatic?
Depends on the depiction.
Depends on the depiction. Is he awkward?
Also depends on the depiction.
Yeah. You think he'd be the same across the board, but there's some differences there. Yeah. In the original film, he is mysterious, yearning, secretive, sad, lonely, troubled, confusing, loving, musical, gifted, intelligent, beautiful, tender, sensitive, haunted, passionate, and talented.
And queer.
And queer. Oh, depending on the version.
That's also true, depending on the version.
So we're just going to get right into it. Today we are talking about the talented Mr. Ripley and Ripley on Netflix, two versions of the same Patricia Highsmith novel. And we're talking only about the media properties, not the Patricia Highsmith novel. Sorry, literature fans.
Yes.
I'm Nicole.
I'm Rolando.
And I'm Eddie Z.
Wow.
Wow. Right, oh my God.
Wow. It's because Eddie didn't say anything at all during that call.
I know, seriously. I think that's it. I'm going to blame you, Eddie. Jeez. And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
An original podcast
about unoriginality.
You had some news that you wanted to share, Rolando, at the top of the podcast. You had texted me and you were like, keeping it very secretive.
I already told you. I told you the news. I told you it wasn't ready for the audience. But
a little premature. Well,
just a little bit.
We could talk. Actually, if you're listening and you're in the New York area and you want to see us in person, then you should come to Anthology Film Archives on Thursday, May 16th, I believe, at a 7 p.m. show. And we will be hosting a Q&A of some avant-garde cinema. So we're getting a lot more involved with some original films, which is not usually our forte since we usually specialize in unoriginal media.
Right.
But we are on the board for the Thomas Edison Film Festival. We got contacted to host this event and we were really excited about this opportunity. So if you're interested in seeing some new, fresh, experimental work, you should end, or if you just want to see us in person, you should totally come to Anthology Film Archives Thursday, May 16th, 7 p.m. in New York City.
And we'll be sure to put the links in the bio. Oh, wait, what? Links in the bio. I'm sorry. Jesus. We're like reverting back to like the past. No, I'll make sure to put the links in the show notes, guys.
Yeah, seriously. I don't know. We're playing a part. Maybe it's fitting for today's episode. We're like reverting back to our old scripts and trying to play the part. We're a little too obvious at it, maybe.
I think so. Well, you know, so speaking of that, right? I did not realize until rewatching Talented Mr. Ripley that it was a period film. I just thought that's how they dressed in Italy. Like, you know, it's
they probably do dress like that in Italy and across Europe, but that's great. I love that. So you had seen the movie before?
I had seen the movie before. Hadn't seen it in, I guess, almost those full 25 years since it passed.
Wow.
I didn't see it in theaters.
So you saw it when it came out?
I didn't see it in theaters, but I definitely saw it when it was like on like Showtime or HBO or whatever.
Okay. And Eddie, what about you?
I didn't see the movie. I've seen bits and pieces of it. But not really not really the whole thing.
I was shown this movie at film school when I went to the New York Film Academy. That was back in 2007. And so it's been a long time since I've seen it. And it was kind of like, you know, how to tell a story about a character, how all the different story arcs that they go through and whatnot. So this was one that was shown to me also in like one of the big projectors in like the movie theater room. So I had a big impression on me, but I hadn't seen it since. And yeah, so I'm excited to hear our takes on revisiting this property. Before we do, though, we should talk about the fact that this is based on a book briefly. Again, we're not here to talk about the book. But we are here to mention a little bit about the author, Patricia Highsmith, mm-hmm. who's best known for not only writing this whole series of Ripley, because she writes about five books. About Talented Miss Ripley, Ripley Underground, Ripley's Game, The Boy Who Followed Ripley, and Ripley Underwater.
This all sounds like Dexter related.
An influence, perhaps, even though quite different, but maybe. But she's also known for books like Strangers on a Train, which got turned into a Alfred Hitchcock movie, and the book The Price of Salt, which got turned into a movie called Carol.
Oh,
that came out a couple of years ago.
She was a self-hating lesbian, wasn't she?
Yeah, apparently, by all accounts, people said she was a miserable, rude human being who preferred to be alone and was a curmudgeon. But boy, could she write. And she really loved to write stories about like existentialism, identity, morality, things that are very present in the Ripley book. So, and she also known for psychological thrillers. So now we're here to talk about the Netflix series, Ripley. That's starring Andrew Scott, and the 1999 The Talented Mr. Ripley. But there's actually another film called Purple Noon that came out in France in 1960. That was the first ever adaptation of a Ripley book.
Which would have been a year after the book was released, right? I think.
No, the book was released in 1955.
Oh, 1955. So 5 years later.
Yeah. And it's contemporary to the book. So any time that they would take this book, they're going to put it, it's going to become a period piece, mm-hmm. essentially.
Right.
So it's always going to be in the 50s. Purple Noon, 1960. It was the film debut of Alain Delon, who became a huge French movie star.
Is he who plays
one of the prettiest Ripley? Boys in the world. He plays Ripley. Yes.
Yeah, I think you can say that. He was so hot. I thought he was so handsome. Like, it truly makes Matt Damon and Andrew Scott like pale in comparison, quite honestly. The only thing missing was that he needed like stronger arms, right? His arms were a little bit like skinny. But other than that, like he had a beautiful face.
Yeah. Now, Alain Delon is quite a beautiful man, and he went on to be a huge movie star in all of Europe. I would agree that out of all of them, he's probably the most breathtakingly pretty.
Mm-hmm.
But funny story, guys, audience. So we were like, okay, let's focus on Talented Mr. Ripley and Ripley. And then I was like, actually, there's a French movie. And then we kind of left it like, we don't necessarily have to watch it to cover it. We should focus on the English language ones.
Yeah.
And just before we hopped on, Rolando's like, oh, be right there. I'm finishing Purple Noon. I'm like, what? I didn't think we were going to watch it. So twist the
indeed.
Tables have been turned.
Because silly me for assuming that it's a French film that Nicole hasn't seen. Like, that was my reaction when she told me I haven't seen it yet. Like, oh, I just assumed you had already seen this like years ago.
Yeah, no, I have not seen this movie. And actually, I did really want to see it. I didn't get to it in time. I'm sorry. I'm a terrible podcaster. But please tell me about Purple Noon before we get into the properties that we all saw.
So for the most part, Purple Noon follows the same plot line as The Talented Mr. Ripley and Ripley, right? They all follow the same story beats, which is Mr. Ripley has been sent to to Italy to kind of woo the son of the Greenleaf heir back to America. And in doing so, he becomes enamored with the lifestyle and commits a crime and assumes the identity of the murdered Greenleaf, right? And I say murdered Greenleaf because like the names are different in the French film and the rest of the movies, but in this version his name is Felipe. And they kind of in Purple Noon, the big difference is kind of the treatment of the dynamic between both Mr. Ripley and Greenleaf, which is Greenleaf is like really, really mean to Ripley. And it kind of justifies the murder, in my opinion. Like, what would drive a man to, like, murder someone?
Okay.
He was a straight-up dick. And despite the fact that he was also really handsome, right? Like, all the Greenleafs kind of have a similar look to them in all three of these properties. But yeah, so he's kind of an asshole. And I think he kind of deserves what he got coming to him. But from there, Ripley kind of becomes more... He's just trying to cover up his tracks. He's always trying to stay one step ahead, ends up committing another murder that is ultimately what will lead him to get caught in this one, right? In the end, it doesn't end. The movie seems like it has two endings. Like, the original ending, I think, is of letting him get away. But then it seems like they tacked on the ending of the cops finding the body of the actual of Greenleaf and coming to question Mr. Ripley. And that's how the movie ends. So I don't think I honestly do think that ending was kind of tacked on. But it was a French film, so I don't think they were, you know, subjugated to any code, as far as I know.
No, they weren't, not as hardcore, at least, mm-hmm. as the one in the States. So
yeah,
maybe it was just the 60s and people were like, he shouldn't get away with this, bastard.
Right, maybe. But no, it was the Mr. Ripley was so handsome. The fashion, I think this one also trumps the two other adaptations. And it could be because since it's a contemporary film, right, it's contemporary to the storyline, you're not making costumes, these are just the actual outfits that you were probably wearing out there in Europe.
Felt more authentic.
It did feel so, but it also looks so good. Like, some of these outfits were just so nice, and these men are just so, like, broad shouldered, scrawny armed but broad shouldered, and like just tall and thin and just like models.
And was he supposed to be American?
He was American, yes.
Okay.
He was American, as was Marge. Oh, wait, no. I guess not. He was talking French, so I guess he's French. But he's supposed to be from San Francisco.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's where... So it's not New York. It's San Francisco where the Greenleaf fortune lies.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that if they're speaking French predominantly, right, they're in Italy, but
I didn't even think about that, but yeah. They speak French in the entirety of the movie, but they're in Italy.
There we go. Did you like it?
I loved it. I found myself really, really liking it a lot. It's also the shortest of all three.
That's important.
By 10 whole minutes, but still, it is still shorter than The Talented Mr. Ripley. Maybe 20 minutes, actually. I think Talented Mr. Ripley is like 2 hours and 10.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, 2 hours.
This one was 1 hour 50, so it's 20 whole minutes. It saves. Yeah, for the most part, beats are the same. The only difference is... There was like a weird scene in the beginning of the film where like both men are like kind of making out with this floozy and they met off the street. And I was just like, so French. But even
that sounds very French.
But even the treatment of Greenleaf to Marge was like vastly different. Like there was borderline a toxic relationship. And why she was so sad that he is missing, I don't know, is beyond me. Like, I think all the other ones kind of had, like, a different dynamic where, like, maybe you felt the sense of, like, a relationship. This one, way less so. Mm. But again, I attributed that to the French.
That's just how the French treat their women.
Yeah, I think so.
Sorry.
You throw the manuscript overboard and laugh at her face. It's just like, God, that's so me.
Oh, damn, that happened. Yeah. That's hardcore. Okay. Interesting. So... the dynamics between the three of them will change from media piece to media piece. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting hearing that Dickie's borderline. I mean, he's toxic to the point where he's abusive.
Yeah.
In that one. That absolutely. I mean, murder, is it ever really truly justifiable?
Yes.
Does sound like they're trying to make it that way.
I'd argue.
Depends on the. Are we talking about like self-defense, maybe?
Well, yeah, obviously. Which is, I would argue, like in The Talented Miss Ripley, like a little bit on the justifiable side.
In The Talented Mr. Ripley?
Yeah.
That's not self-defense.
That was definitely self-defense.
That was not self-defense.
It was totally. Well, you know what? We'll get to it.
We'll get to it. Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about the year 1999, because it's probably one of the best years in movie history.
Wow.
Yeah, outside of the fact that The Talented Mr. Ripley came out this year, the highest grossing movie of that year would never tell you it was the greatest movie year, because it was Star Wars The Phantom Menace.
That was the highest grossing movie that year?
Of 1999, yes. And I'm sure we all remember seeing that in the theaters and talking ourselves into thinking it was good. But the other movies that came out that year were The Matrix,
okay,
The Sixth Sense,
oh yeah,
Fight Club.
Which is rumored to be, you know, oh, I don't know if you're aware, but there's a new M. Night Shyamalan movie coming out.
That's the one with Josh Hartnett trapped.
Yes, but
yes,
the theory right now is they announced it as part of the overall Shyamalan universe. So the question is, which one? And people are thinking it's got to be The Sixth Sense, because we're done with the Glass series, because, you know, Bruce Willis is really not able to act anymore. So the obvious connection is most likely going to be that Haley Joel Osment's character is like a detective that's bringing justice.
Interesting.
That's the theory. I don't know. We may have to cover it, is what I'm saying.
Okay. I would. Okay. We'll put that on pause for later. But yeah, Eyes Wide Shut came out that year. The Iron Giant, Toy Story 2, and Tarzan, and South Park's movie came out that year.
Toy Story American 2 Beauty, came out?
Toy Story 2 came out that year.
When did Toy Story 1 come out?
1996 or 5.
Wow.
One of those two. Yeah, that's I know. Crazy. I remember seeing Toy Story 2 in theaters. American Beauty, The Green Mile, The Virgin Suicides, Magnolia, The Mummy, okay. Notting Hill, Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me.
Which is a superior
film. It was a
film.
Pretty fucking... I mean, like, if you've not seen it, you've at least heard of these movies or you have memories of these movies. It was a pretty epic year that kind of closed out the decade. I mean, not even the decade, the century of the 20th century. So, and this movie came out that year. It was directed and written for the screen by Anthony Minghella, who is also known for his films The English Patient and Cold Mountain. He died really young, so he didn't really get to make a lot of films. He also made a film called Truly Madly Deeply.
You know, I've never...
Breaking and Entering.
Those movies look so boring, both of those.
The English Patient?
And
I'll tell you. I saw Cold Mountain when it came out. Don't remember a thing. But I saw The English Patient in, like, the last 2 years, and I was really aggravated with that movie. I was like, this is not good.
You sound like Elaine from Seinfeld.
Oh, she hated it too.
That was a plot line, yeah, for one of the episodes.
Oh my god.
The English Patient, and she almost got fired because of her hatred of it.
Yeah, because that movie won Best Picture when it came out. Apparently, I don't watch Seinfeld. It was a sensation. I'm with Elaine. It was not good. Talk about toxic love. So maybe, and that was also based on a book. I know the book was also celebrated. Whatever. Anthony Minghella, though, decided to follow that up with The Talented Mr. Ripley. And I think it's by far and away his best movie. But, you know, comparatively, maybe not saying much. This stars Matt Damon. He was in talks with Tom Cruise for the role.
And Leonardo DiCaprio.
Both passed. And both have also been rumored to be gay. So,
Is there a rumor about Leo DiCaprio?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I don't think I'm familiar with that one. I think I heard the rumor that Leonardo DiCaprio was more like the Ryan Seacrest kind of a pass around boy, but not necessarily gay. Gay for pay, basically, right? For the roles and stuff. But not necessarily his identity.
Any man who parades overly, like, all the time with models, I feel like you're hiding something. But whatever. It's their private lives. We would love it if you guys came out and supported us, but whatever. Anyway.
I mean, whatever indeed. Like, do we need these men in our circle?
That's a whole conversation about whether or not coming out would also ruin their careers, though, you know.
I guess that's fair.
I was having a conversation the other day with someone who was like, he was saying something like, oh, I can never see him as a straight man. I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. Just because he's queer, he's openly queer, you can't see him play a straight man in a movie. And yeah, this was a queer person saying this about, like, Jonathan Groff or something.
Oh, that's so interesting. He said, I also feel that way sometimes.
But you see, that's why these guys stay in the closet, because they're petrified.
But Jonathan Groff proved me wrong when I saw him in Mindhunter, for example, right? And he was playing a heterosexual male in that show.
Yeah.
And he did it convincingly. So does, I mean, look at Neil Patrick Harris. Neil Patrick Harris played like the biggest womanizer on television. And after he had already come out.
He was in the midst of it.
He did it
while he was in his show. But whatever. Grant, I know, but a lot of people do think that way. And I'm trying to combat that. So whatever.
Andrew Scott's another one. I mean, look at him in Fleabag.
Yeah. We'll get to Andrew Scott soon enough. But yeah, so this is an all-star cast in terms of 90s, early 2000s people. We got Matt Damon. We got Gwyneth Paltrow right off of Shakespeare in Love, Oscar win. We got Jude Law and his youngest and tannest. We got a fucking really young Cate Blanchett, who went on to be one of the best actresses in the world. Mm-hmm. We got Philip Seymour Hoffman, who went on to be one of the best actors in the world. Mm-hmm. And then we got just a bunch of, you know, cameos by really famous people whose faces you know and names you probably don't.
Right. Like Dad from Mr. Ripley. I didn't know who he was. I've seen him so much. I have no idea who he is, though.
Exactly. Yeah. Tons of character actors that you know. So, okay. The year is 1958. It is New York City. And Tom Ripley, played by Matt Damon, is approached by Herbert Greenleaf, who thinks that Ripley attended Princeton with his son, Dickie Greenleaf, Richard Greenleaf, a.k.a. Dickie Greenleaf. And he's like, look, I'm going to give you $1,000 if you travel to Italy, where Dickie's living off of his like trust fund, and go there and convince him to come home, right? Because, you know, this is what people do, I guess, with money, is that they do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, there's no way that you would ever, you know, take the money and run. So Ripley travels. He actually befriends a woman on the way, a socialite named Meredith Logue, played by Cate Blanchett. And the moment he meets her, he tells her he is Dickie Greenleaf. So from the moment, even before he meets him, he's already like thrilled about this new life and about the potentials of who he could be and embracing a different identity.
Yeah. Well, we should have figured it out that he was embracing, like everyone always points out, like, oh, this is the moment we start seeing him lie. Like, he lied when he said he was in Princeton to the family.
Yeah, pretty much, lying. Yeah.
I don't think
the guy made the assumption.
He was a liar, but I don't think he necessarily, well, we'll talk about it. I don't think he was necessarily, that doesn't make him necessarily a villain, a monster.
No, it doesn't at all. Everybody lies.
Totally.
To an extent, so. So he, you know, pretty much he spots Dickie with a girl named Marge, and he, you know, pretends that he's running into them and that he's a friend from Princeton, and he ensconces himself in their lives. And they become pretty friendly pretty fast.
I know. That's such
to the point where
privileged white thing to happen. Like,
I know. But if you were in the middle of like a foreign country and someone was like, hey, I know you from Princeton, you'd probably be like, oh, person from the States, feeling of home. You know, I want you to come into my life and remind me of what it is to be home. I believe that.
I don't know if I would.
That's not that hard for me. Well, you're not very friendly, Rolando.
I just feel like I'm like con artist.
And it's also and it's also that idea of like vacation friends too.
That too, yeah.
That's also,
yeah.
That's also true.
Get that mix.
Absolutely.
But this wasn't Greenleaf's vacation. This was like his lifestyle.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, it's somewhere in between both, you know, because he doesn't have a job and all this stuff. So he goes and immediately tells Dickie, like, hey, I've been sent by your father. You know, he paid me to come here. And Dickie loves him for his honesty and for the fact that his father has done such a ridiculous plan. And they become fast friends. And they pretend that, you know, Dickie's almost going to come home so that he could kind of live off his father. And they're all kind of abusing this poor man, even though I'm sure.
Poor.
He's not poor. This rich man.
Yeah.
Let's just say that. And after a while, you know, the friendship, it blossoms and it blossoms. He pretends to love jazz for Dickie, who loves jazz. You know, he spots Dickie cheating on Marge with a girl named Silvana. And he goes on many trips and all this stuff with him. Yeah. They play chess together while he takes a bath. And of course, things quickly get a little confusing for both involved as to what's going on here.
Wait, so you read it as Matt Damon being confused for his feelings?
No. I think the both of them were not on the same page, at least.
Oh, no, most certainly. Like, I think, okay, so I do think Greenleaf was well aware that, like, this gay man is infatuated with me, right?
Yeah, and so he didn't know that he was gay.
Right.
And then it becomes pretty apparent after a while that Tom is very clearly gay, even though he claims to have a fiance waiting for him back in New York.
Right.
The tub scene where they're playing, and Tom is like, ooh, it's cold. Can I get in? Talking about the water, Dickie kind of looks at him like, no. And then Tom, you know, quickly saves himself by saying, I didn't mean with you in it. You kind of can't save yourself after that.
That's a hard one.
Especially if someone says no. Yeah. And then, of course, Dickie gets out of the tub, bare ass showing.
Gives him a full show,
Mike. Tom is just, gives him a full show because I think Dickie's that kind of guy who probably likes the attention.
Right.
And is Tom's just staring at him.
Well, I mean,
Dickie turns around like, are you staring at me?
In Tom's defense, Dickie had a ridiculously big ass for like a straight white guy. Like, no straight white man specifically deserves to have all that ass. Like, it was just too much.
Well, that's the thing.
I was surprised.
Dickie, as played by Jude Law, is of like, who wouldn't fall in love with him? I mean, he's got the life, he's got the looks. He's got the personality. Mm-hmm. He's got the charms. He's kind of got everything. I don't know. What do you think about Jude Law playing Dickie Greenleaf?
I mean, I never found Jude Law like attractive.
What?
Yeah. Can you believe? Like,
that's
I never
surprising.
Was. Although shockingly, I found him hot when he was in that Harry Potter movie as Dumbledore.
Dumbledore.
I guess age. Like, I think age worked on.
No. Yeah. The daddy. He had that daddy.
Like,
professor.
Once he got look. Older, like, because I was never like I was never into like waif like guys, which is why I was surprised that he had such a humongous ass.
So I thought that he was one of the most at the most attractive in The Holiday with Cameron Diaz.
Yeah, he's really pretty in that.
He was really good looking in that. Like,
I've never seen it.
Oh, it's very good.
But I do think he's very charming, right? I love him in Spy, for example, where he does a comedy with Melissa McCartney. But I never found him like she's like fawning over him, just like, why? What's the attraction?
See, I think he's very pretty. I think he's borders that line for both, you know.
Yeah, like, maybe that's what it is. It's too, maybe he's too, like, the features are too feminine. And just like, as my gay mind is just like, no.
It could be, yeah.
You know?
But he's very tan, too. That's also kind of alluring. I don't know.
Is it? About I mean, sure.
Someone who's very tan.
It was like just, a nice golden tan.
And his, but his personality is just, he loves life. He's got so much energy. He's free spirited.
Yeah, he was a little
he's
bit
confident.
Of a playboy.
Total playboy, all that stuff.
For
so
sure.
Who wouldn't be tenant? So quickly, the relationship between Dickie and Tom turns a little sour, mm-hmm. especially when they meet up in Rome with Dickie's friend, Freddie Miles. And all of a sudden, like, Ripley's kind of, what's that word? Like, he's kind of latching on mm-hmm. to Dickie, Tom.
Like a lamb breed.
Getting possessive.
And he was also getting a little possessive. Also, yeah.
Yeah. So, and Freddie's kind of like looking at him like this guy. And now Dickie is very turned off and wants to kind of get, you know, kind of get this monkey off his back. Meanwhile, Marge is very hospitable to him. Mm-hmm. Marge has a very close friendship with him and trusts him and feels bad for him, especially when he sees that Freddie and Dickie are kind of leaving Tom out. And I think Marge always suspected, too, that he was queer.
So she
has more of an understanding for him.
The girlfriends always know, right? Like
the girlfriends always know.
Like I had a crush on a street friend and stuff, and the girlfriend called it out like immediately, and she's like, "Oh no, oh my god, maybe I was living my own Miss Ripley life."
What's your real name, Rolando?
You'll never know.
I'm sorry, baby boy. You got to go down. So one day when they're in San Remo, because Dickie wants to leave, and he's like, also, by the way, this was fun, but you should like either go do your own thing or go back to America, because I'm going to move to San Remo, and you can't come.
And this is also when, like, now Ripley is like confessing his love. It's like, but you love me, and like, we're going to like, you could dump Marge, and we'll just like move in together. Like, bro, cool it.
Yeah. Also, the father kind of cuts off his supply, so he no longer has this money that he can live off of. And Dickie's like, yeah, I don't want you to follow me around anymore. You're kind of being a leech. So Tom's kind of, his world is getting turned upside down. He's like, what am I going to do? Am I going to go back to New York? Am I going to be without Dickie? You got to be kidding me, kitty. And he's on this boat, and Dickie's just not being understanding. And he says to him, too, like, we got to get rid of Marge. We got to be together. And Dickie just rips him a new one. Mm-hmm. You know, he's like, who the fuck are you? Kind of like calls him out for being queer in a way too. Calls him a girl. This is mm-hmm. what they did back in the day, because that was an insult. And
was.
It still is, actually. Damn. Yeah. I mean, you know, Ripley's like, oh, you're just afraid of your feelings. And he just starts taunting him to the point where Ripley can't take it. He takes the, what is that?
The oar,
mm-hmm. and he smacks him across the face, mm-hmm. doing like blood comes trickling down immediately. Spoiler alert here on in. Spoiler. And Dickie starts to defend himself and wants to, you know, retaliate and hurt Tom. But Tom just, you know, says, let me kill you, and beats him to death with the oar.
Yeah. So the first hit was clearly like, you know, an act of passion. I think it's mm-hmm. the legal term.
To stop the taunting.
Of yeah. course. Right. But then it became a moment of self-defense, because it clearly wasn't hard enough to like kill him. But now the other guy was going to kill him. So it's just, you had to defend yourself.
Well, watching the movie at the end, you realize that what he's doing is that he's actually getting to the truth of who Ripley is, and Ripley can't take it. So it's such a crime of passion for him, because it's like he has such a violent and physical reaction to somebody seeing him for who he really is. Mm-hmm. And Ripley, you know, lives in denial. Right. Ripley not only lives in denial for the rest of the movie when he takes on Dickie's identity, but about who he really is and what he really wants.
Dick.
And which is Dick. Yeah, he wants Dick. Okay. So,
you know, it's not really the most hidden meeting here. Like, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah, I wonder if Patricia Highsmith even intended that. Was Dick like the euphemism back then for penis? I don't know.
Good question. I don't know.
Yeah. So
I want to believe
maybe
yes.
that she had really good luck when she did
that. She really did.
So he actually embraces his dead body, and they kind of hold each other. Well, he holds him as if he was holding him before. You know, he devises this whole plot, which is that he's now going to assume the lifestyle of Dickie, take his money, wear his clothes, wear his ring, and lie to everybody that Dickie's off somewhere.
By
his plans, kind of
by happenstance, though. It's not that he like this is all like when he first gets away with it by accident, is when he realizes like, oh shit, maybe this is something I can't do, and then he from there just is constantly just trying to like figure out how he can just like skirt by as Dickie.
As Dickie,
yeah,
yeah,
and
yeah,
so,
it's something that's kind of gets out of control. Yeah, that's the thing. This movie also wants you to know that Ripley isn't this like con artist who was out to do this and who, you know, was like manipulative and had this end goal in sight from the beginning.
Right.
That was not who Ripley is.
It just happened and he's just going along with the flow. But
yeah,
he is really good at forging documents, although it does make me miss the days when it was so easy to commit forgery.
This is the 50s. You know, things have absolutely changed. And back then, you know, they didn't even look twice at your passport.
Yeah, like, it's just like, this looks nothing like him, but all right, sure.
Anthony Minghella put in a bunch of little things, too, to really talk to the character of Tom. There's a scene where he's imitating them when he was on the balcony, both him and her.
Mm-hmm.
He's not only doing Dickie's voice, but Marge's.
Yeah, which is also in the French film. That was actually one of the... He does the parlor trick in front of Felipe, right, in this version's Dickie, and Felipe was like so impressed by it and wanted to know, like, oh, that's so cool, like, do it again. So it's like, it is like a power, like a gift, a trick.
Yeah, so he's really good at doing impressions. He's really good at analyzing handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And he read like Dickie's handwriting to him and stuff. So he's got like little ways that he could show that he has the power to be deceptive, you know, in more fun ways and socially acceptable ways and then in darker ways. And also, there's like the scene where we like hear them talking, but they're distant in the background and he's watching him pour the coffee. And I think that's when he's actually paying attention to his mannerisms.
Mm-hmm.
At first, you think it's because he's enamored with him, which he was, but because then he's kind of studying him.
Yeah.
So now this movie does something that I assume the book didn't do, because I don't think Purple Noon does this and Ripley certainly didn't do it, which is the character of Meredith.
Yeah.
And the character of Peter.
So those are two characters that are original to the, what's it called? Original to this script. I think Peter is a different character that shows up towards the end of in Purple Noon.
Okay.
Yeah, but like he is not a love interest.
Well, so by adding in this character, this movie becomes very much like a cat and mouse game. And like literally he's like going through revolving doors to changing identities.
Oh, yeah.
Especially it did feel like very, at the opera and stuff.
Yeah, right. It did feel very much Three's Company.
Yeah. Like, and but in a weird way, it makes it more suspenseful, too, because like the
why does it feel
the
like
stakes are higher.
Why does it feel like Three's Company?
Because he is pretending to be Dickie, right, at the opera, and then he bumps into Marge, and now he's back to having to pretend to be Tom. But mind you, the Kate Middleton?
Kate Blanchett.
Blanchett.
Middleton.
Is like yards away, like looking for him, so he has to like hide a high. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's simply by taking on the glasses and putting
them on. Yeah, yeah. It's just like, right.
The difference. I think he said, isn't that a quote from the movie? Like the difference
Superman.
Between Clark Kent and Superman.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you look like Clark Kent with him off. Yeah.
But that's also, mind you, that's a scene where it seems like Jude Law is kind of flirting back a little bit with Ripley at this point, right? So I understand the mixed feelings that Ripley has here.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I would as well. I think, and that's the thing, like the movie does a really good job at letting you see how all of this were just a ripple effect of one another. It was cause and effect, you know? So nothing was like, he's not this master manipulator. It all sort of was happenstance for him. Doesn't mean that it's right, but it was. So everything's going grand until one day Freddie Miles shows up at his apartment and is like, where's Dickie? And obviously Freddie has taunted Tom. You know, he caught him peeping at Marge and Dickie when they're on a boat earlier in the film. And he was like, Tommy.
Enjoy the peep show. Wink, wink.
Yeah. What do we think about Philip Seymour Hoffman in this movie?
I liked him.
I thought he was so fucking good as Freddy and the way he taunted him.
I don't know if he was
even
so
like that thing
good.
He was
like,
doing.
I liked him.
I think even in the piano, though, when he was like playing it and like the way his eyes would move and stuff, like that had to have been improvised or something. But it adds like such like a fuck you and I'm like, I'm taunting you level to it, which isn't present in, let's say, the other property. So he gives so much to his Freddy that I appreciate.
His Freddy was definitely stronger than the French Freddy. right? Because that's a big, that's ultimately like what will lead to like Ripley's maybe downfall, depending, I guess, on the property. So, yes. But
because, yeah. Because then the private investigator gets involved and then he has to go back to assuming Tom. And then it's like, oh, did Dickie kill Tom? And like, and then it just, it becomes this whole thing. We won't spoil the end in case you haven't seen this movie, but the end of this movie is...
It's been 25 years.
Fantastic.
Twist.
Yeah.
It's just like...
Yeah, I mean, we usually... Do we always spoil?
We always spoil the end.
I mean, once in a blue moon, we...
This is a 25-year-old film, and the French one is from the 1960s. I think it's okay to spoil this.
What's so unique about this ending, though, is that it's very much Anthony Mangella's injection because of this character of Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just... This movie is the queerest out of all of them.
For sure.
And it really took that as its theme, and it ended up being this whole thing about like hiding who you really are and the shame of hiding, like the shame you feel about who you really are.
Mm-hmm.
And in this sense, he feels not only the shame for his feelings for Dickie, but the fact that they resulted in murder for him, and that now he has to keep committing murder and or else he'll be caught and everyone will know he's a fraud and that he lied and he'll go to jail for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
So the stakes are quite fucking high for this guy. But it was all simply because he loved him.
Yeah.
And now he can't experience real love because of it, even though there's a man who is there telling him how wonderful he is and who wants to love him. But Tom realizes that, you know, he's never even going to see him for who he really is. You know, and and he doesn't even know how to be who he is. He says like this whole thing about how I'm like stuck in the basement.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's so interesting. That's how you took it, because it's more so about like, because... It's so much more. It's also like kind of accept. Well, there's like an acceptance of loneliness here, right? He's just accepting when he kills. I'm spoiling it. He kills the love interest because Cate Blanchett appears on this ship yet again, because this woman's always on a fucking boat for some reason. I guess it's what Europeans do, like socialites. But she's on a boat. And so in order to keep the facade up, because he's pretending to be now Ripley, he gives her a kiss. And now the jealous lover sees this. They have a little bit of an altercation on the boat, in their room. And like, kind of, Ripley just wants him to just stay in the room for the rest of the trip, which is kind of a hard ask. Like, who wants to stay in the little cabin for however long a cruise is? Not I. So, I don't know. Peter had kind of a point there. But in order to keep this lie going, right, he chooses to kill Peter and throw him overboard while crying, you know? And that's also kind of him accepting this fact that like he's probably going to be alone for the rest of his life, because he is a is he a sociopath? Do you think he's a sociopath?
I mean, yeah, at this point, yeah.
I don't know if he does. No.
I wouldn't be able to pull this shit
because
off.
Because of how emotional he got, he never killed unfeeling. There was never any coldness in his murders, right? He always seemed a little guilt-ridden by them, especially by the third murder, which is not the sign.
That was a little bit more of a calculated one.
Well, yeah, that was probably the most calculated, for sure. Well, I don't know. I mean, filling Freddy was also pre-calculated when he heard him coming back up, and he heard, you know, Freddy putting everything together, right? Because that's the other thing, right? It's always the landlady. In all versions, it's always the landlady that kind of spills the beans that, like, no, that's over there, Mr. Greenleaf.
Yeah.
And in all versions, Frederick kind of puts it together and comes back upstairs, and then that's where he dies.
Yeah. I mean, I do think he's sociopathic, though, because I think you kind of have to be in order to continue on with this and be like, it's a good idea. Yeah, no, I should just keep on doing this. It's kind of, you ever see that Futurama episode with Leela?
Probably not.
Where she just like, do you guys watch Futurama?
Sometimes.
Well, there's this like episode where it's like an alternate reality, but she like keeps on killing the moment anyone suspects her of anything, and like she just becomes highly paranoid and like will kill at the drop of a hat.
Oh.
And it becomes like a farce because of it, and his life has now turned into it because it's so ridiculous that he would think that this is a good idea, but he does, and he keeps doing it. You know, here's a person who wants to love him, and he's gonna kill him just because he'd rather do that than be honest. Being honest,
I don't think that's a sign of a sociopath.
So what makes a sociopath, Rolando?
I'm pretty sure a sociopath is usually very unfeeling. Like, they have no remorse about what they've done. Like, or, yeah, like, a sociopath, I'm pretty sure, feels no remorse for their actions. Or is that a psychopath?
I think that's maybe a psychopath.
You think that's what's it called? Eddie, see if you could Google this for us real quick. But I'm pretty, one of them is...
Excuse me, I'm not that guy.
You used to be.
Yeah.
You used to be our fact checker.
I know. So yeah, we need to hire one.
Antisocial personality disorder, sometimes called sociopathy, is a mental health condition in which a person consistently shows no regard for right and wrong, and ignores the rights and feelings of others.
Right. He's not, which he doesn't. He is the he's only right now, all his behavior tends to be just in the purpose of saving himself, which I don't think categorizes him, therefore, as a sociopath. Right. As opposed, the reason I'm saying this is because that is not the depiction of the new Ripley that we're getting.
Oh, okay. So in a juxtaposition between the two, then yes, the second Ripley is absolutely a sociopath.
Right. He's much more uncaring. He's much more unsympathetic.
Yeah. So should we just get into it, the new Showtime / Netflix one?
We might as well get into it just because there's so much overlap in terms of
compare
and
contrast. Yeah, exactly. And then especially for this one, we're going to do a lightning round.
Hooray.
So I want to hear those. Okay. Ripley by Steve Zaillian, I think. He used to be a screenwriter, but now he's actually starting to direct stuff. He wrote the screenplay for Awakenings. He wrote the screenplay for Schindler's List.
Oh, okay.
He wrote the story for Mission Impossible, for Gangs of New York, for American Gangster, for Moneyball, for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, for The Irishman, right? He has a whole reputation of being a formidable screenwriter. And he's directed and written Searching for Bobby Fischer.
Never heard of that.
A Civil Action with John Travolta. All the King's Men, which came and went with Sean Penn.
Is that
and now one? This.
All the King's Men is about the presidential investigation or something, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, you know that movie. Okay.
Uh-huh. Oh, I do love a good political thriller.
Oh, okay. That's one of your favorite subgenres. Nice.
I mean, I wouldn't call it one of my favorite subgenres, but I do enjoy it as a topic. Most, you know, I like politics and stuff in my media.
You like politics? I had no idea.
What? Oh.
Okay, so this is actually a limited series, so I don't think there's going to be a second season.
They say that, but I don't know. White Lotus was supposed to be a limited series, and then it got a second season, so...
True. Well, I don't know if people are talking about this as much as...
Mayor of Easttown is also another one that I think is getting a second season.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
Me neither. Don't roll your eyes, Nicole.
Kate Winslet would have been a better movie.
Maybe. Any chance for me to see Kate Winslet just stare at the screen and just like pierce it to my soul, I will take it.
I agree with that. So this is an 8-episode series on Netflix, and it's the same exact story as Purple Noon and Talented Mr. Ripley. And it's an adaptation of Patricia Highsmith's crime novel. It's in black and white. It stars Andrew Scott as Tom Ripley, Dakota Fanning as Marge Sherwood, Johnny Flynn, who I don't think I am familiar with, as Dickie Greenleaf, and Elliot Sumner as Freddie Miles, the big roles.
Yes.
So let's talk about this. Okay. You guys start.
Okay, fine. I'm going to start this off.
I want to start.
You want to start? Fine. Go, Eddie. You've been very quiet, so...
Yeah, please share.
First of all, I really like this. Really like this. I just want to say that. How can I say this? It is like entering the mind of a psychopath and just kind of being pulled into this world where he sees himself like the main character, but so detached from all these people and the relationships around him. Like, feeling alienated, and I'm very much kind of just been intrigued about just even setting this in the most beautiful places in Italy, and it being black and white, and not having any color to distract me from the main character, and trying to figure out his intentions, because still I'm watching this and I'm not fully encompass of what this character's main intention is. You know, like, what is his underlying life goal in all that he's doing here? Because it's not just survival. It seems more like to steal kind of take the wealth and of others and just like wrap himself around it and immerse himself and drown himself in it. Mm-hmm. Those are just kind of the thoughts that just kind of came out right now. Just my main thoughts.
Yes.
Okay.
Which is, I mean, I agree with you in that sense, right? Where, well, all right, I'll give you my thoughts real quick, Nicole. I thought shooting this in black and white initially was going to be so fucking pretentious. And I was confused. Like, why are we doing this in black and white? Why? And yet, by the, I think by episode two or three, I was just like, oh, you know what? I kind of like it in black and white. It looks really nice. It looks really, really pretty. And it does give it like almost like a film noirish like feel, like a mystery of some sorts. It felt very also, I don't know. It feels like the black and white for some reason for me feels very Italian, like Italian cinema. That's just me. But I do, and another thing, I was very confused by the casting of Elias Sumner as Frederick, Freddy, because I was just like, is this person male or female was the first question. It felt very, very, not confusing. It felt very, very distracting at first. But I will say this, when Freddy comes back to, for his big scene, right? He's referred to as a him in the show. I think the actor is a non-binary person. I was just like, oh, you know what? This is a very different portrayal from that of Philip Seymour Hoffman that I kind of preferred, to be quite honest. Like the reads Elias Sumner's character gives Ripley were so cutting. And it was so, so much. I feel like it was just so much more biting. It was just like, I loved it. I thought it was great. But yeah, I was just, but yeah, the black and white for sure threw me off for a little bit. In terms of us getting a point of view of like who is Ripley and stuff, like I think for me, this show, it just feels so much colder because Ripley is so unfeeling. He's so, so calculated in all his movements and stuff. And it's not like any of the other two portrayals that I've seen of Mr. Ripley, where Mr. Ripley in the film, down to Mr. Ripley, he's so much more charming. He's so much more friendlier.
Yeah.
And Andrew Scott is not doing that intentionally, right? It's not like he's giving a bad portrayal. It's just a very different portrayal that they're trying to give this Ripley version. Because he's also older, and he is clearly a con man right from the beginning. We know this for a fact, that he's just conning people out of their money and stuff. So this is just where... And to Eddie's point, it's just like, what is his motivation, right? Like, it's not just survival for him. It just seems like he is like absolutely out for getting something that is just not his.
So I got to disagree with you on the element of Ripley not feeling. I think that what we're seeing is all these feelings that he's experiencing being just buried very much deep. There is a lot of the different scenes where you can see they take a shot of the character's face, and you can see in the lines him adjusting his face to either be very blank when he's confronted with something that brings anxiety or may challenge him, or a sense of moment of feeling like people are
alienating him,
or being like things are suspicious, you know, people are looking at him suspiciously. He has this moment of like correcting his face, and you can just see it, just like the lines, the way his eyes shift, and it's kind of like taking this emotion and just bringing it down and staying calm. I gotta stay in character.
Which is a credit to Andrew Scott as a performer, because we recently saw All of Us Strangers, right? And that's a role that could have been easily just dull. And yet, like, he is able to do stuff with his face that just makes you feel like the emotions that he's feeling. I don't know what it is. He's actually really, really good at that. And it's such a unique gift. Similar to like I was saying with like Kate Winslet, where she just stared at the screen and it just kind of pierces through your soul. Like he has like a subtlety in his facial acting that like actually does transcend sometimes like just like the words and stuff. So I agree with you on that one. Fine. But I don't know. I still think he's just colder. He's just like, he's a monster in this one more so.
Yeah. No, he's definitely a sociopath and incredibly calculated. And I think for me, a big reason why I didn't really connect with this is because I think that the whole point of Ripley is supposed to be that he's this con artist of not only money and stuff, but by personality. And this is not a man who is charming. This is not a man who knows how to actually convincingly pull off what he's doing. He's actually really bad at what he does. And everyone's immediately suspicious of him. And he kind of is just hanging on by a thread. And also, Dickie's like kind of way more idiotic in this one. Like, they don't even give him... Everyone completely lacks a personality in this movie.
Oh, it's like Marge.
They're all just kind of... In this show,
No.
They're all just kind of like staring at each other and not really connecting in any way, shape, or form, and just like sizing each other out, but like not showing any personality beyond that.
Interesting.
And so I didn't find that I'm like... She called him the talented Mr. Ripley because that's what he's talented at. He's talented at like getting himself into your life and making you trust you and like conning you into making you think that he's a good guy and that you could trust him. And that's why he gets away with everything, because he's so convincing at it in terms of how he acts. And that's also what a sociopath is, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like Ted Bundy was known for being incredibly charismatic. And it's actually, at the end of the day, not probably good. If someone's overly charming, that person is probably capable of really bad things. So it sucks when they completely decided to eliminate that element, because then everything doesn't feel as organic. And the choices that people make don't make as much sense. And then it takes so long for everything to happen because it decides that it needs to be a miniseries. Mm-hmm. And I'm once again going to stand by the fact that this did not need to be 8 episodes. This could have been a 2.5-hour movie and everything would have still been received. The messages would have still been received.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
I don't need a whole episode of his con life in New York. Like, that could have been 10 minutes.
Sure. Look, I don't disagree with you on that one. Like, I don't know if we needed to have like an 8-episode miniseries. It could have easily been like just, you know, if you want to do a miniseries, just do like a British one, like 4 episodes, right? It didn't have to be 8. I will agree with that. I disagree in terms of like how, of the fact that he wasn't good at his like conning as like kind of like a misstep, because I actually kind of preferred it, to be quite honest, because I think in both Purple Noon and The Talented Mr. Ripley, the way he's able to just kind of like slip and slide through the system starts feeling a little bit like farcical. Like, for example, when we talked about like how it felt like very Three's Company when he is trying to like hold on to 2 identities in one night, right? It feels a little silly, right? Where I do think it's appropriate to have actual people probably more realistically like be like, this seems odd, this is weird, that's suspicious, that doesn't make
sense.
But from
the moment they meet you, because literally like the moment, first of all, the encounter between Tom and Dickie and Marge is so awkward.
It is.
The only people on the beach, which was also a choice.
It is.
And
I thought that was mean girl energy. It's just like, it's like,
because from Marge looks at him and it's like, I don't trust this guy.
Right. But you've never encountered that? Like, you've never had that.
Yeah, but so does Freddy. Like, literally everybody looks at him that way.
No, Freddy was more interesting, because Freddy was not like that. Freddy was just like, oh, we met in New York, which I was more curious about that. It's just like, do they have like some sort of backstory here? Did they go to like the same sex party? Because Freddy does seem like the person to be at sex parties. You know what I mean?
Yes. But he didn't seem to be more of like, I'm going to size you up kind of a way.
Fine. Maybe. But I actually, I kind of wish it was a little bit more Freddy, to be honest. Like, because Freddy was only there for like that scene and then like for the episode where he comes to confront
him. Yeah, again, like it's 8 episodes long and we get 2 fucking scenes with Freddy. Like, do we even care that he gets killed?
Mm-hmm. That kind of great opening, like, of the series where we're dragging Freddy's body out.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, to me, it doesn't. But then, like, why are these people hanging out with him?
Well, I don't know.
If Marge doesn't like him and it's like a really awkward encounter and like we don't really see them laugh ever, then why the fuck are these people, like, how does he ingratiate himself in their lives? Like, that's why that choice right there isn't as impactful for the rest of it, because the whole thing is that he's talented at this. He's supposed to be good at this. And as far as I'm concerned, at least, like, conning people personally and, like, being a charming guy and making you think I'm a good guy that you can trust, he sucks at it.
Well, Marge is for sure the one who doesn't trust him, but Dickie seems to be much more... See, this Dickie is also very different from the previous Dickie, right? Where the previous Dickie was a flanderer, right? We know he cheats. Mm-hmm. He got another lady pregnant and then she committed suicide when he wasn't going to financially take care of her, right? We forgot to mention that. He's a party boy. This Dickie seems much more reserved in terms of, like, he is devoted to this relationship with Marge, because he's also an older guy, right? Like, these are both older characters. So you also have to take that into the, kind of like the reading of it, where Marge is clearly significantly younger than Dickie and both him and the other one. But anyway, my point here, though, is that like Dickie is the one who seems to like have in the initial friendship. Like, he does seem to like to have Ripley around, despite how awkward he is. And it could just be part of the fact that it's just like what you had mentioned before. It's like, oh, you know, it's the American. It's like, you know, you know someone from your past. Sometimes it's nice to have that around. I don't know. And Marge,
it could be.
And Marge, but there could be scenes. Thorn.
It could, yes, and it's true. But it's only one episode, by the way. From the end, at the end of that episode, he's already annoyed by him. There's not enough scenes to show this natural progression in their relationship, especially because of this choice they make. We were even talking about the fact that, like, the choices that Anthony Mangella wrote in the script, we knew everything we needed to know about Dickie. Like, he probably liked the fact that Tom was staring at his ass, even though he's homophobic. You know, but there's not enough to Dickie for us to hypothesize about that because he's just kind of a wet blanket. And then they also don't have enough time to like build his relationship. And then it's like when he kills him too, they're just like there on the boat and it's like, all right, well, we're going to go skiing without you. And Tom's like, I get it. And he's like, okay, cool. I'm going to turn the boat around. Like, I'm like, what the fuck is happening? Like, why is everybody just so dead? Like, maybe. Why is everything just so like, it just almost felt poorly and like lack of emotion and poorly written.
I don't,
and way too long. Everything was way too stretched. I don't need to see every single step to him disrupting this boat. Why are you so enamored by the sociopathic behavior? Now I get it. And I'm going to give that to Eddie in the sense where the show's really interested in that. And it wants to explore that and see through the mind of it, but almost a little too much to the point where it's kind of missing the whole fucking point of how he's actually able to do it in terms of like connecting with human beings.
Right. But I don't think this Mr. Ripley is trying to connect with human beings.
But he kind of has to in order for him to do what he has to do.
You having, so same, so here we go. And this also could connect to like the queerness of the other talented Mr. Ripley, right? Matt Damon's Mr. Ripley was queer. He is gay. We make a generous suspicion to say he's gay, right? And he hates that a little bit about himself, but like when he sees a glimmer of hope that maybe he can be a little normal, right? Having this friendship with Dickie or with Peter by the end of it, right? Like, he's going to latch onto it. That's what he's after. He's after for connection, right? That's why he can be so charming. This Ripley does not want that. This Ripley doesn't care. He's borderline asexual, right? Like, he has no interest in either sex. He has no interest in connecting with anyone else. All he's after is just seems to be just like, just the riches, just to get by, just survival, right? It's a very different Ripley. And I think that's ultimately what we're seeing here, right? Like, where the other one is looking for that human connection. This one is just not. He has no desire.
And you granted. Can tell,
and we got
but he's from- also, but he's conning them. He doesn't have to actually be interested in it in order to at least fake it to get to be in these people's lives.
He does.
That's also the difference. He might not actually want that, but he has to fake it in order to be like, hey, I'm your buddy, right? Hey, Marge, no, you trust me, Marge. And when he does, it's a terrible attempt at it, and it's so awkward.
But then...
And everybody sees through him.
No, just Marge and, like, the Italian maid.
But yeah, but also, Dickie's an idiot, and they chose to make him one in this.
They chose to make him much more aloof on this one, I would
agree. And Freddie, again, like, Freddie, the moment he looks at him is like, this guy is a... who the fuck is this, Tom? What are you doing?
Well, yeah, but that's always been Freddie. That
comes across as, like, why are you hanging out with this riffraff?
This loser.
You know, this is not a person like of our circle, you know. And if anything, I probably know him because sometimes I like to dumpster dive into and check out some skeety things because this is me and I like to be interesting and have character. But at the end of the day, I'm wealthy and my shoes are from Venice, you know. There were moments where I felt I put myself in the eyes of Ripley, looking at Freddie. And it's like, yeah, I could see myself punching this guy in the face. You know? Like, they're more like this, his whole attitude, I can understand why Ripley was so antagonized by him and wanting to, if I can't take your money, I could take something else. You know?
Like, take your life.
Take your life, yeah. Who's gonna get that?
And not even like the life, like his like literal life, it's like his lifestyle. Like, you know, that yeah, it just I don't know. It's a different read for sure in this Ripley, but like it's not necessarily, you know, it's not one that that like it didn't bother me or anything, right? It's not like I don't know, it's not like
story wise, it's a lacking it doesn't it just has a ripple effect on the rest of the story.
There's certain things that I found interesting that they did. One was, first of all, you have like Dickie and Marge, and they seem like to be wealthy kids and living off like their parents' trust funds and stuff like that. Well, just who's a general? Don't interrupt. Okay, don't interrupt me. Okay. But it's like she's a writer, writing about her little experiences in this little town, right? And he's a painter, trying to be a painter. And I love that they have the moments where he's like, when Ripley's looking at his paintings and he's like, what the fuck is this shit? You know? And then he really wants to like, it's so obvious. He really wants to like get Marge on his good grace. So he's like, I'll read your stuff. You know, convinces her to read. And he's just like totally editing it to death. You know, this was a moment where I wish they would use the color red as he was just marking all that shit up.
Yeah.
You know, but I just found that interesting because that was actually beneficial for her. That was like a moment where she was like appreciative of what he did for her, like looking at her art and giving her critiques on it. So that was like a weird moment of like, oh, that's weird.
Yeah, that was her starting to like trust him. But that should have been there in the beginning. But, I don't know. It kind of was off.
But then it was, I'm not even thinking about like the trust factor, whatever she felt for him. I just felt like him wanting to do it and doing it and then doing it critically and like with effort, like putting the effort and doing it. I found that interesting. You know, it's like, if I don't like you, and then I do a job for you, it may not be the best job I ever would do with someone, you know? But he did this really good job for her, according to her. And I just found that just very interesting. Like, why would he do that for her? Why? What would they
I
need?
Think he, yeah. And I also do actually, now that we're talking about this, I actually do think Ripley just did not like these two. Like, I don't think he loved the lifestyle, but he did not care for these two people whatsoever. And I think we know this because of how much he hated climbing those fucking stairs to get to their place.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know those stairs. Like, yeah, they made a lot of time with those stairs.
And I really do think part of that is just because, like, it's just building this internal anger you now have for these persons for, like, living this, like, fucking, like, why? Like, almost making it so unattainable. So difficult. Mm-hmm. So
how much more sinister would it have been than when he like saw them and he was like, hey, besties. But no, it's like the contempt shines through on his face. I don't know. For me, that just doesn't work because then it doesn't make as much sense emotionally.
Now I'm sorry.
I think his motivations are clear because they did that great scene where he's like writing a letter to his aunt who he has nothing but contempt for.
I also like.
So it's clear. It's like he wants to be somebody, you know, he wants to prove all the naysayers wrong. And he has a lot of trauma because he was probably dumped on his aunt because whatever happened to his parents. So this is a guy who like everyone looks at him like Freddie looks at him. So I get that. But it would be stronger if he had more character. I love Andrew Scott to fucking death. And I'm so angry with what they gave him.
I don't know. I liked him a lot in this.
I did. I dug it. I did. And I love
the cat and mouse game between him and the detective.
Yeah. And there's a moment in I don't know if anybody noticed this, but it's when he's sitting across, he's on the couch with the detective, and the detective's questioning him for the second time. And there's a moment where his eyes just go kind of almost completely black, like dead, like just dead. And he looked very hollowed out, like really, like there was like nothing inside, like his soul just left him, and there was just this corpse animated speaking to the detective.
And at least whatever little bit of soul he had left at this point, right? Because by now he's just been so devoid of any human empathy, right? And that's the thing.
He truly has.
I mean, the character has been lacking any empathy, but again, that's not to, it just like, I don't know, for me, I dug it. Maybe what I'm realizing as we're talking about this, though, is because like, I am also kind of one of those people who, when I'm not happy, like it will show on my face, like no matter what I could do. Right? So just like if I'm talking to people I don't like, I know this from experience from when I used to work in retail, like it's always going to show. So I can empathize with this Ripley a little bit more.
Okay.
And whatnot. Yeah. So I, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm going to agree with Eddie on this one. It's just like, I'm going to defend this show. Like, it's just like, no, the smart choice was making everyone so suspicious of him and him constantly kind of like fumbling a little bit. Like, he does fumble a lot, like, yeah. In terms of his lies. He's not as slick of a liar as Matt Damon's character is, but I like that.
Makes people, make them suspicious, but maybe make it a little bit more subtle. Like, I don't know. Something about the way he handled it just was not.
I feel like the Italianos in the 60s, they were just super suspicious of Americanos.
I mean, like, why would you want to hang out with people who are just looking at you like this the whole time? I mean, I don't know. I hang out with you.
That's true.
We're so always judging you.
maybe I'm just used, and they're straight. Like, come on, why would I hang out with that? But let's do a quick lightning round, okay?
Lightning round.
Let's start with Freddie Miles.
Oh, okay. I'm gonna go with Elias Sumner. There was the performance ultimately just like won me over. I thought it'd be so distracting casting someone, like it was distracting when I first saw. It's like, wait, this is who's playing the Philip Seymour Hoffman character? That's a weird choice. And I thought that it would keep bothering me. But then when we came to the death scene, it was so well put together. And I think it was paced so well with like Freddie's questioning. And it was like a quick like rat-tat-tat-tat. Like, well, it was more like rat-tat-tat-tat from Freddie's point. But like Ripley was so bad at trying to keep up. That it just made it so much more cringy, and I loved it. I love that scene so much. Yeah, Elias Sumner for me.
Eddie?
I agree. I really understood why Ripley wanted to
kill Frederick.
Yeah.
Frederick?
I could just imagine.
Frederick was so,
I just imagine,
so much cooler too.
Getting like that kind of like persona, like, don't worry, I'll come back, I'll bring the cops.
What? Yeah, it was what? So cold. Vicious. I loved it. But and Freddy, yeah. This Freddy was way cooler in my opinion. Like, just like this, I would want to hang out with this Freddy.
So I'm going to go with Philip Seymour Hoffman because he's that asshole. This is the type of person who would bully me. This is the type of straight person who looks at me with contempt and who wants to mock me and antagonize me for being myself.
You don't think Elias Sumner's Freddy would have mocked you?
Maybe, but more so in terms of, you know, bulky straight guy. Who, you know, looks at women as toys, objectification things.
Justification.
And I don't know. I love the way that he fucking taunts him, the character choices that he makes as an actor. He made me laugh, and even though at the scene, in that scene, I was despising him.
What?
That's
when
good
Reggie
acting.
Is like, what's it called? Walking around being like, well, where, what's it called? Well, you're sleeping here, aren't you? Because Tom would never, what's it called? Dickie would never wear anything that hideous.
Yeah, that's really good. All right, so what about Marge?
Okay, this might be another a popular opinion here. I kind of preferred Dakota Fanning,
yeah,
as Marge over Gwyneth Paltrow. First of all right, cat out of the bag here. Gwyneth Paltrow is kind of insufferable, like in the Townsend
kind
Mr.
of
Ripley. In the Townsend Mr. Ripley. Not in real. I can't speak to her in person. I'm sure she's okay, but in the Townsend Mr. Ripley, completely insufferable. Why? Someone who looks like her would like the storylines with Marge always drives me crazy because just like, why are we so accepting of the man writing you letters for a breakup? Are we just like still like fawning over this Ripley? It's not Ripley, Dickie. Like all three versions have like just been so heartbroken when they get a breakup letter being like, I don't know. That's like the equivalent of like texting nowadays. It's just like, you kind of maybe dodges a bullet. Although
you wouldn't be heartbroken if Eddie broke up with you.
I'd be mad. Not heartbroken. I'd be so furious.
You would be heartbroken?
I'd be heartbroken. I think both are apt. Are they not?
I would be more angry than heartbroken.
You would be heartbroken?
I would be heartbroken, wow. But I would like be so that. Angry that you did it via text.
A cat's out the bag.
That I would be searching for revenge.
Eddie, what about you?
I do enjoy Gwyneth Paltrow. Yeah, I'm going to go with that. But I really, it was really nice to see an adult Dakota Fanning. If that makes any sense. Like acting, just like, yeah. I haven't seen her since really, maybe I missed whatever, but I haven't seen anything since Twilight, when she was in Twilight. So it was just good to see her on the screen and just play this kind of, this character. So
I also prefer that, like, this version of Marge was way more suspicious right from the get-go.
Yeah, yeah. She was suspicious.
She was. Like, she was just like, you're suspicious, after, you're after my suspicious man. Gear.
I know, yeah. It's more tragic for Gwyneth Paltrow because she trusted him and then she's the one who realizes, yeah, oh my God, no. He fucking killed him.
Yeah, she's the only one who puts it together.
The Dakota Fanning was like, I wouldn't, it wouldn't faze me if he killed.
Well, yeah,
because... I know. That's the thing, because they're also devoid of emotions.
Well, because Dakota Fanning was Ripley by the end.
So, my God. This is the one I'll probably say Dakota Fanning for, because I really enjoyed that scene where she antagonized him when he came back. She's like asking him all these questions and she's just like going with it just to see what he's got. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, why is he still in San Remo? He's in Rome. Mm-hmm. Why? But I thought you said he was going to do this. So she's not anybody's fool in this one, which is definitely one that is a nice change from the 1999 one. So that leaves us to Mr. Dickie Greenleaf.
Okay. I'll start. I'm going to go with Jude Law. Jude Law was a better Dickie Greenleaf, and that I'm counting for all three of them. He was just for the badunkadunk, let's be real. But no, I think there's a reason why he got an Oscar nomination for having all of 30 minutes of screen time, really, you know?
Yeah. I think that the hands-down choice is Dickie Greenleaf. I think the role was written better for Dickie in the movie, and I think that he really just nailed it. He's the kind of guy that, yeah, you'd want to be with, and then you'd want to kill to be. I mean, I wouldn't, but, you know, mm-hmm. some guys might want to. And, yeah, he just had so much personality. There was so much to that character. Sorry, I would also say Jude
Law. Look, I'll say this also. Jude Law was way more handsome out of... is the handsome one out of the three actors that I've seen, but yeah. They all had the similar hairdo, kind of like the similar style, similar. Like, there was just like, there was an archetype when they cast all three men.
Absolutely. Eddie?
I would go with Jude Law on this one. I just felt like the other one didn't give me enough of the character.
Yep.
To just, I agree. There was just too much not saying or doing anything. Yeah. For this character.
I know, 8 episodes and not enough. Not enough. Sorry, I'm just going to keep writing.
I know. So I really love it. I'm on the last episode. I don't know how it ends yet. Okay. At least how they're going to...
You don't know how it ends?
I know how it ends. I don't know how this ends. But, yeah.
Okay. All right, cool. Tom Ripley, who is everybody's favorite Tom Ripley.
All right. Well, my favorite Tom Ripley... I don't know if he qualifies, but would be Alain Delon's Tom Ripley. He was my favorite one out of all three adaptations. If I'm going to go... No, you know what? That's it. It's just going with Alain. He's my favorite one. I think he was because his motivation was greed, but I feel like also justified.
So, because of that,
I'm going to go with that one. I did, but that's not to say that I did not like... I also do like Matt Damon's performance, and I also do like Adam Scott's performance. Andrew Scott's. Adam Scott's the guy from Parks and Rec, my bad.
Eddie?
I'm going with Andrew Scott on this one.
Why?
I don't know. I just feel like he is... this character is grabbing my hand and leading me down this darkness... in the darkness depths of whatever ocean is in his head that he just keeps on picturing or being attracted to. And I'm there for it. Sorry, Nicole. Wow. I saw you roll your eyes, Nicole.
And it's just proof of point that, like, yeah, clearly there's some people who would fall for, like, this Ripley shtick.
This is true. This is true.
Although I'm hearing me to get too. Like, I might have too. Like, be like, oh, you're the awkward guy. I can't. It's very, like, you feel stronger when you're surrounded by someone who seems like bumbling. Like, you can think that you're better than. Maybe that's the play.
Yeah. This is going to make a great TikTok video because we all chose different ones. I'm going to go with Matt Damon because also in terms of his situation, his was way more intense. He had way more people he had to lie to. He had way more like situations that he had to maneuver in his favor. Like when he's hoping from afar that that whole cafe scene goes in his favor and then he can come down and be Tom Ripley. And he can be Dickie Greenleaf by taking his glasses off. And he's Tom Ripley by just putting his glasses on. And he's charming. And he's talented at what he does. So I think that, and also everything was just kind of circumstance for him. This is different probably from the Patricia Highsmith novel, where he's a little bit more of a calculated con artist and whatnot. But for the queer subtext, I'm here for Matt Damon, and he did a really good job. I hear that this is Matt Damon's favorite role that he's ever done.
Really? So
there's that too.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
I think that in terms of Matt Damon, I always think of him as like, you know, that guy who makes movies with Ben Affleck.
Oh.
He's just so not that here.
I think
it's so different for him. So
I think of Matt Damon from
Matt Damon. Yeah. But
I
guys,
do like Matt Damon, though.
I do like him too. I think, yeah, he's got a bad rep. Guys, listeners, what do you think? Which version do you prefer? Have you seen all of them? Which do you pick for the lightning round? Any of these questions that you feel like answering, do so by reaching out. Reach out to us by emailing us at remakesrebootsrevivals@gmail.com. Hit us up on Instagram at remakesrebootsrevivals. Hit us up on Twitter at remakespodcast. You can search for us on Facebook and YouTube by just searching Remakes Reboots Revivals Podcast, and we will pop up and you can listen to episodes there on YouTube. You can also listen to all episodes on our Podbean, on our website, and of course to whatever podcasting platform you are listening to. And if you are listening on a podcasting platform, please give us a rating. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review. We've gotten some recently that we have been meaning to read, and maybe next episode we keep doing this, we'll read that online. We never remember. I'm sorry, guys.
Yeah.
We got lives that we just we can't remember.
My God,
that sounded sassy.
It did. It sounded like
that wasn't meant to be. I know, so much personality came through there. Jeez. Okay, so we don't know what we're covering next week, but
2 weeks.
You guys will in the next episode, I should say. So we will inform you then. But we will see you for the next episode. And any last thoughts?
I want to go to Italy.
I would love to go to
Italy. I love some. Yeah, I was like, oh, I've been there. I've been there. I've been there.
Oh, that's nice. That's damn. How nice.
Please don't bash my head in with an ashtray. Okay. All right. Let's just say this, though. If he didn't have a phone, a lot of this would not be a problem.
I mean, you can say that about everything.
Okay, no. You didn't have a phone. A lot of this would not be a problem. That's it.
And that's the final thought.
And many scenes when that phone would ring and he would just stand there reminds me of me every time the phone rings. And I'm like, don't know the number. I'm like, I'm not going to answer it. So
that reminds me of the Scream video we did, right? Because I feel like everyone empathized.
Yeah, he goes,
everyone empathized with Eddie, be like, yo, no, that's me. I would never answer the phone.
That's true. All right, well guys, until next time,
stay original.